The Committee for Brisbane acknowledges the original custodians of the land upon which this podcast is being produced, the Turrbal and Yuggera people, and pays respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
Well, hello everybody and welcome to this podcast. I'm Professor Alan Patching. I am the Vice President of the Committee for Brisbane. I'm very proud to serve also as the Chair of the Connectivity Subcommittee for the Committee for Brisbane. And what we're here to do today is to record an interview with a very interesting person on an unusual, perhaps for some people, aspect of connectivity. We're not going to be looking at rail. We're not going to be looking at highways. We're going to be looking at the connectivity between points in a city that are normally travelled by foot, by cycle, by scootering, and means such as that. And we've got an absolute expert to help us out with learning about this, and that's Michael Major. Michael Major holds a master's degree in interior architecture, and he spent many years in England working on shopping centres, among other projects, before moving to New Zealand for a while, and then seeing the light and moving to Australia. And I say that cheekily, if any of my New Zealand friends are listening. He's been in Australia now for 8 years, and he's an expert well known throughout the world, as well as in Australia, for a topic known as neuroarchitecture. Michael, I don't think I need to go any further because the listeners are going to be intrigued by the term. Could you give us some insights into what neuroarchitecture is?
Thank you, Alan. That's a great introduction. Neuroarchitecture, well, let me just start by saying this is an emerging field. It is not an established field yet, but what it draws on is how we respond to space as we move through it non-cognitively. We're not aware of it. Winston Churchill basically said in 1941, we shape our buildings and afterwards they shape us. And that's a well-worn phrase, but it sums up quite specifically with how our environment affects our mental and physical well-being and the way we behave. There are four principles to neuroarchitecture, and they are sensation and perception, experiences, which are old, memories and new experiences, and fourth, the decisions we make. Let me just expand on that. So sensations and perceptions are basically how we process the world through our five senses: touch, taste, auditory, sound,
and smell.
I always forget one of them. And yeah, I was saying the other day, I was quite concerned with my youngest son. When he was a baby, he was just licked everything. And I had this vision, we would go into a cathedral when he was about 10 and he'd wander over to a column and start licking it so he could get the experience. Anyway, we process the world through our five senses. Those senses form our judgments of whether we are enjoying the experience or not. And essentially, it's do I want to stay or do I want to go? And this is really about safety. Because our brains are still hardwired for the savannah. Despite all the technological advances, our brains haven't moved at the same rate of evolution as technology has. So we still process the environment as if we're on the savannah. Are we going to get attacked? Are we going to, if I see that bit of a red berry, is that going to be poisonous or is it going to be something that's edible? Smell is another one. If we come across some meat and it's putrid in smell, we're not going to eat it. So when we understand these primal drivers that affect us, we start to realize that the environment we live in has a very direct effect on how we live our lives.
So if we took those principles and you started off applying them not just generally in architecture, but specifically in your shopping center architecture. Could you give us an example of applying the principles and the impact they have on the design of a shopping center from the perspective of the user of the shopping center, a customer?
The first shopping center I did, I was introduced to the spatial psychology. It was a five-level shopping center, and the desire by the leasing agents and the client was to have all five floors at the same sub-tenancy rate. It wasn't that the first and the ground floor was better at a higher rate than the top floor. All five had to. So how do you move people vertically and horizontally through space? And these were the first sort of indications of what attracts people. Because as Homo sapiens, one of the primal things that we have is curiosity. Because we have to be alert to the environment. Am I safe? Am I not safe? So we look for visual clues that draw people from one floor to the next in a very powerful way that people go, I want to go there. And you offer surprise and delight at the top floors that they wouldn't have got at the ground floor. So there's a changing dynamic going on all the time to encourage that creative, that curiosity to engage and immerse people into the environment.
And is that why we see so many glass balustrades around openings in shopping centres so people can look up and see something of what's upstairs through the glass balustrades?
Yes. And we have, and we had this problem because we were going, we need to have visual. But then people were going, but this women wearing short skirts, there's a problem too.
Mm.
So you've got this juxtaposition of visual, being highly visual and being too visual.
Mm.
So there's always, it's a complex. There's many ways to you address that.
Mm.
And we did. And it's highly successful and still is today because of those principles that we applied. What the other thing that is really important is that everyone has their own individual experiences and their own particular aims for being wherever they are. Some people may be just wanting to go in and buy a pair of socks and they want to get there as quickly as possible.
It is in and out and,
in and out,
get it done.
You know, men are much more destinational shopping than women. Women like to browse.
Mm.
And I've likened it to sort of three levels when you're walking around a shopping center. And this applies outside too. There's the high traffic. I've got to get there quickly and it's very intense. And I liken that to sort of house music, drum-based music.
Mm.
It's unrelenting, it's powerful.
You're moving to a beat.
Moving to something. Then there's the secondary route. So you have your primary route, your secondary route, and your tertiary route. And your secondary route is you're not in meandering. You're there to get a purpose, but you're also browsing.
Mm.
And it's still quite destinational, but you're not in a hurry. And then the tertiary one is really where you can start to relax and recharge. And this is really important. Mm. If you want people to stay somewhere for a longer time, you have to give them the chance to recharge. So in shopping centers, food, and museums, you see it in a lot of places. If you want people to stay longer, feed them, rest them and feed them. And the stats originally were around 8%. They would stay 8% longer. And in retail terms, if you got them to stay longer, there was more unplanned purchases.
Mm.
And these principles, whether you're in a shopping center or in a store, are still the same. And when I did my master's, I was going, well, these principles actually work externally as well.
Yeah, so let's go into that area now because we've had a very succinct and thorough explanation of the principles of neuroarchitecture within the shopping centres. So if I could summarise those first, I'd summarise them as simply saying shopping centres have to be designed for people who want to get in and out quickly, but also for people who want an experience of browsing, which would be more the case, say, in the Middle East, where they go to the shopping centre to enjoy an afternoon away from the sun and without ramping up their own air conditioning bills. So you need to deal with those who want to browse, those who need to go in and out, but also from a shopping center owner's perspective, cater for both categories, but also encourage them if they're not in a rush and they went perhaps with the intent of just going in and out, that they get intrigued and go, oh, I wouldn't mind going up and see what's happening up there.
Yes.
So it's catering for all of those three categories you mentioned.
Yes.
Now, if we were to take those key principles, the four principles you started with and the three design principles, I guess, or categories, and move that outside, because really what we're here to talk about, having established the theory behind it all, is the external spaces and the connectivity between them, and what I'd call the minor connectivity, even though really it's probably major, but I'm comparing it in size, if you like, to rail and road. We're talking about paths and footbridges, places where people can walk, run, stroll, glide on skates or use skateboards or cycles or bikes, that sort of thing. So how do you translate or transfer the principles to that environment? Because it's a lot bigger.
It is a lot bigger, but fundamentally the principle is still the same. You have to, with anything, start with the end in mind. You have to be the end user focus. And when you understand the dynamics of the end user and what they want, what their wants, needs, aspirations are, you can start to create an environment that caters for that. When you're looking at a whole city, there's obviously a real mashup of wants, needs, and aspirations. So you could say it's a little bit more challenging. But the reality is the principles are still the same. If you want to have people connect from point A to point B, and you want them to move fast, you have a more transactional experience. And I would say the bridges in Brisbane fundamentally are transactional experiences. They're just functional.
Yeah, get across the river as quickly as possible.
And when you think back through the ages, there's some beautiful bridges that are highly romantic.
And my mind goes immediately to Prague and that famous bridge there.
Yep. And you go, there are joy. And I was thinking about how do you position Brisbane in the globe stage, and a friend of mine said, oh, it could be a city of bridges. But we quickly worked out that this wasn't romantic enough.
But we are heading in that direction.
We are.
But unromantically, as you say.
But it's more transactional. It's functional. Well, yeah. You know, that's the way things are. Mm. But that doesn't matter. The point being is, do you want people to slow down? Do they need to go fast? Do you want them to stay curious? Because I think, from my point of view, some of the most famous cities are the ones that are totally walkable. Because every time you turn a corner, there's something else.
But isn't the answer to your questions that you just asked similar to the shopping center?
Oh,
you
totally
want them to have a choice.
Yes. So people can move fast, move more, less purposely, but they have an aim in mind, or they just want a meander. They want a promenade. And we are, as an animal species, one of the most social animals. We like to promenade all through the Middle East and the Mediterranean. People promenade. Mm. And we go to people watch, and we want people to watch us in some cases. What I find intriguing is, just sort of slipping back to shopping centers. Shopping centers are the largest public spaces that have been built since cathedrals. Mm. And it says something about society that shopping centers should be the largest internal spaces that people frequent. And I think, while I'm deviating away from the main topic here, but it does have an impact on how society works. And we have to be cognizant of, yes, there's neuroarchitecture principles at play here, but we're also talking about the way we do things, the culture and the rituals and the rites. And when you bring those other elements in, you can weave them into the experience of connecting destinations, or it's, some people call it placemaking.
Yeah.
Placemaking is really about community initiatives, going out to the community and asking them what they want. Destination is more in the territory of, as Henry Ford said, if I'd asked them what they wanted, they'd have asked for faster horses. Destinations is about taking that stretch, taking things beyond what people know but love. And it's amazing how many people love bold gestures. And when you're doing neuroarchitecture, you really play with these bold gestures to make an impact, to separate that experience from another experience.
So if we were to talk about that principle of working with bold gestures, and we look at the external, not just central Brisbane, but let's start with that, because a lot of work to be done. How would you recommend Or is there an example of a bold gesture that works here already? And how, if so, how would you, could you tell us about it? And if so, how would you recommend we get more bold gestures, and where would we have them in Brisbane?
I think the most obvious example is we live in a subtropical climate. And that's what we need to amplify. There are gestures towards it throughout the whole city. We just need to go, let's just go for broke.
I mean, what are the best gestures? Sorry to interrupt. What's the best gestures?
It's the shaded subtropical climate that we're in. Some places have indoor-outdoor environments that we're not... In Northern Europe, you keep the cold out, so you have very small doors. It's open and you go inside and shut them really quickly. Mm. Here, you don't need doors except for security. Mm. Because there's a seamless transition, and that's the beauty of Brisbane, I find, is this seamless transition from indoor to outdoor because of the nature of the weather here. Mm. You know, I was at Speaker's Corner on Wednesday night at a function, and it was 9 o'clock, and I was still in shirt sleeves. Mm. You know, that wouldn't happen even if it's middle of summer in Britain. Mm. Well, perhaps once a year.
Once or twice. if it's a good season.
So that was celebrate the environment. And if I was doing a bold gesture for Brisbane, I'd go amplify it, put a complete blanket of foliage over the whole CBD, and then run it out through the main tributaries over the next 30 years.
And you're dead right, because when you talk about a blanket of foliage, you're talking time. It's just implied. But am I right in presuming, if I can join some dots, so we're going to take examples of, say, the arbor at South Bank, and we're going to take an inner city example of the rather well-developed trees down Queen Street Mall, and we're going to extend that concept between those two points and as far as possible around the city area?
Yes. I would go... Because I like the byline, not a city of bridges, but a city in a jungle, the subtropical capital of Australia.
We've talked about this before. It's kind of like the subtropical version of the tropical Singapore.
Is that
what you're talking about?
And I'm saying amplify it. When I first started talking about this, I used the word steroids, and someone said, you can't use that when you're talking about the Olympics. So I walked it. But I'm really saying, if you're going to do a bold statement, you've got to deliver. Mm. And it's got to be a city that's in shade. It has to be a city that celebrates the environment it's in from a landscape point of view and from an architectural point of view.
Well, speaking of landscape, one of the best developed green areas in the city, of course, is the Botanical Garden.
Yes.
Do you regard that as a good example of the foliage you're talking about together with the points of interest you're talking about?
I did the other day. I was coming home from a function, and I decided to walk from Eagle Street through to South Bank train station. And so I had the experience of urban life, pavement walking. Then I chose to walk along the riverfront in front of along Eagle Street. And then I moved into the Botanical Gardens and then over the bridge. So and then into the South Bank train station. That had about four or five different experiences, because I also went through QUT, and there was basketball being played, and there was another dynamic. All the way through, I was having different dynamic experiences as I walked. And I think that is something that is really important. If you want to keep people moving, you can't just do more of the same. You have to have a variety, a diversity of atmospheres and experiences to keep people curious.
You've picked in that walk one of probably the best developed points of interest walks in the city. What other things could you do? Obviously, people at the university playing sport along the way, and there's lovely trees and entrance to the bridge and all those sorts of things. But what sorts of things can we celebrate already having? Gritty, beautiful, musical artwork, pardon me. And what can we add to the city to create these points of interest you're talking about?
Well, a couple of things. I really like walking underneath I use the word motorway. Along the east side of the river, it's gritty, it's different, reminds me of my hometown in Britain, Birmingham. It's raw. Glasgow's raw. Manchester's raw. But they have little diamonds all the way through. And it, the juxtaposition of something raw and then going into something smooth. It's this contrast. So you walk along under the motorway and then you pop out onto the area that's been put in front of Crown Casino, which had been reclaimed, which is lovely. And then you end up in Botanical Gardens. All of those have a different vibe. I hate the word vibe, but it's a common word now.
Yeah.
And what you're doing is creating yourself stimulated. Mm. And what's around that corner? I was really loved near Parliament is the outdoor table tennis and the gym equipment in that colourful space. I thought, well, that was beautifully done. Mm. There's another space which I think is the cafe area under the motorway. That's been turned into a really nice subtropical feel to it.
Mm.
And I think we can do, the thing is with the bold gestures, you do it at a micro level, at a macro level, and you can do it in a micro level because it's the little things that actually put a smile on people's faces.
Give us a couple of examples of the micro level.
So street art can do that. There's a guy painting little doorways. They're like mouse traps, but they're like Georgian doors, barn doors. And it's like, it's silly, it's fun, it's quirky. So you can do something like that. When we were talking yesterday, we in this cafe and they had a little spray, nasal spray.
Yeah.
And you could
fascinating
smell different flavors of coffee.
Yeah.
And so you don't have to spend a lot of money. That's the beauty of it. Having an experience is not about throwing lots of money at it.
Mm.
Yes, you can, but you don't have to. Because one of the things I feel very important about this is I used to say to retailers, if you were to charge $10 for people to walk in and they didn't buy anything, walked out with nothing, but they still felt they spent $10. That $10 for the experience was brilliant. They're setting the bar, saying, because people buy experiences, they don't buy products and services.
Well, that's clearly reinforced by the modern travel industry. They're openly selling, and BMW in their advertising many years ago was selling the experience of driving rather than the beauty of the car.
Yes.
So I couldn't agree more with that. Implied in what you said was that we've actually got some of the areas right.
Yes.
And we're just not using it. For example, the gritty, you mentioned little diamonds like under the motorway. We'd probably think there was more a diamond in the rough, but no.
Some of the best diamonds are there.
Yeah, indeed. but then to come out in the polished diamond when they finish Queen's Plaza and that's a magnificent juxtaposition of experience, which adds to the experience of both. But we've got some South Bank and, we've got little pockets around the city and we're starting to join the city up with these pathways. My concern is pretty much all of them are primarily functional, and you mentioned that before.
Hmm.
How do we work on the bridges? I mean, the obvious one is to provide some shade, I guess. But what else can we do with these connected pathways and bridges to make them not just a transactional experience, but more a compulsive experience where people aren't going because that's the quickest way to get across the river. They're going on that particular route because they want to be on the route. It's so enjoyable and such an experience in itself. What do you do to the pathways? What do you do to the bridges? You mentioned art, you mentioned shade, you mentioned planting. Are there any other things that come to mind?
Well, immersive storytelling, 3D storytelling. We live through stories. Again, when we, Homo sapiens, communicate through stories. It's how our languages have evolved, how we have achieved what we have achieved over any other species. So stories are absolutely critical. And what I think is a real opportunity for Brisbane is to tell past, present and future stories.
Mm.
It's not just about the past, it's not just about the present, but it's also about what's possible for the future.
Mm.
Because if you think about any city as you walk around it, it's a walking advertisement for the city. Do I want to do business here? Do I want to live here? Do I want to come back again for a holiday? Our walking experience, the discoverability of the city, is absolutely critical. And Brisbane has this wonderful opportunity to tell stories in a way that it's going to capture a global audience. And we want that global audience to go, I want some, this is a place to come to.
Well, just as you're speaking there, you have an incredible ability to enthuse or initiate thinking in the person you're speaking with because of your passion for your work. But what came to mind for me was walking across one of the walking bridges, because I fairly regularly do walks around the city for exercise, and having the phone, of course, and then maybe having an app on the phone where you could be holding it up to a particular part of the city.
Oh, yes.
And getting photos of the way it used to be.
Yes.
But at the same time, some projective images of what it might look in 100 years' time or something like that.
Exactly. Exactly.
And maybe tying that even back to Indigenous culture for that reason,
yes,
and art from that region and things like that. Is that the sort of thing you're talking,
yes,
about?
Yes, very much so. So, you know, augmented reality of the past or the future or the present. The Victoria Bridge is on its 8th version. I think it's had previous 7 have washed away.
One of them nearly got wiped out by a ship during the 1974 floods.
Wow. So you see, the point being is that when you stand somewhere, you could use a phone to create an augmented hologram, if you like. Maybe that will happen in the next 10 years.
Mm.
And you can see what life used to be like.
All 7 versions of it. But the interesting point is, you could do that from being under the arch that's been preserved from the very first version,
yes,
of it, which is still it's actually a classic example of what you're talking about, a point of interest with a bit of history, and people are always getting their photograph taken there.
Exactly. And there's another one which you raised, which is where the convicts used to be hung. I never knew about that.
And that's a bit glum.
We don't want an augmented reality of that. But
but it's interesting just knowing the history of it. I mean,
yeah,
you've mentioned in our past discussions that the Britons are intrigued by the ghost stories and the murderous stories from the past. And I'm sure Australians would be too. You look at Sydney with Pinchgut and the people who used to be, it was a hanging place for convicts that,
yeah,
broke the rules way, way back at the start of Australia. Well, that place in Australia was just behind Admiralty Towers up against the big buttressed sandstone walls. And you're right, most people wouldn't know about it. But I'm sure a visitor would be intrigued to walk past and get a bit of that history off a plaque or off an app.
Exactly. And Boggo Road's got its ghost, apparently.
I think they have more than one.
But you see, there's little pockets all over the centre of Brisbane, around the river. And these walkways can connect them and take you on a dance, a waltz, a promenade that leads you around and encourages you to engage, because what you're seeing is unique to this city, to this state, to this Australia. If you've got overseas or interstate, they want to come somewhere where they haven't been before, that they have a unique experience. They don't want to see more of what they've seen anywhere else.
Mm.
They buy the experience and they remember the people.
So if I'm right in summarizing thus far, we've got some very good examples of what should be done. We need more of it.
Yeah.
We need to emphasize greenery in a canopy of greenery is your expression, which is a lovely expression, and Singapore's achieved that. That takes time, but that's no reason why we shouldn't start it. That's some tropical reputation that people come to see. But another very important part of it is each time someone goes out on their favourite walkway or a different one, they see certain things that they love because they're there all the time. But other times, there's a different art show than last time. There's a different busker than last time. And perhaps there's a shaded bridge rather than an open one, so they'll want to spend time leaning on the railing and watching the boats go by.
Exactly.
And while they're doing it, they're using their phone and the app to get a sense of the past from that perspective and the future.
But and you also need to add in, if I went for a walk with you, as opposed to one of my children, I could do exactly the same walk and have a completely different experience.
That's interesting.
Because I'm having a conversation and we're seeing things in a different way to how I would be talking to my 18-year-old. And you see grandparents taking five-year-olds in love with seeing their five-year-olds engaging in a way that they wouldn't normally engage.
Seeing the world through the five-year-old's experience.
Exactly. So the same experience, the same route has to manage all these different age groups. And museums do that exceedingly well.
Yes, no, you did right about museums. They're fascinating. I think also there are other areas of that we could talk to, and they're very much opposed to each other, although they're still based on a religion. For example, major churches in cities around Europe, and here I don't think we use those as well as we could for, you know, attracting people in and seeing part of the history. But the other side of religion here is the sporting venues.
Yes.
And I think we've done that relatively well in Queensland, where they're particularly Suncorp, with the old Lang Park, built in Caxton Street. It's been styled after Cardiff Arms Park in Wales, because I was involved as a project director, which is centrally located between pubs and restaurants everywhere. And Caxton Street's very much the same. And it seems to do it right. The one thing it got wrong was
experience.
Yeah.
If you're absolute footy fanatical, it's an amazing experience to have. Mm. It's very engaging. It's a real fan spectacular.
Now, you mentioned that word. You're famous also, and I didn't mention it earlier, for this concept of fan trails. And you mentioned when we were doing a prep talk for this interview that fan trails are particularly useful around major events. So given that we've just mentioned the events that happen at the stadium and various other venues like that, but we'll focus on the stadium and how people you know, expand into the surrounding area prior to a match, go to the match and expand out after. How does the fan trails fit into that concept?
Well, again, using a retail metaphor, when you think about shop fronts, the window fronts, during every day they have basic merchandise being displayed. But when it comes to Valentine's or Christmas or Easter or Mother's Day, and they bring out all the guns and really dress up the window fronts. So a fan trail is basically pulling out all the stops when a particular event is on. So when you got the State of Origin on, you'd really light up the route from Roma Street Station and other routes potentially to the game venue, and you really celebrate the experience of the State of Origin. Same with the test. Now, where that's going to go in the future is still on the table. So we won't go into that at this point.
We'll get on to an Olympic venue discussion. We'll be here for four hours.
But when you talk about a test or magic round, or you've got conversely a major opera coming or a major art show coming, you can light up the trails or the walkways, the discovery trails as I like to call them, into fan trails. And what happens around these discovery trails also become promotional tours. Because one of the things for Brisbane is, how do you get people to stay longer? And how that has to be communicated in some way.
And give them more things to do.
And this adds to another factor. We have this river. And I think at one time there was a fountain in the river, but that was turned off, I think.
No.
But if you imagine putting a wall of mirror, like a wall of fountains, say, crazy, and you throw digital images onto that fountain, rather like Sydney's Vivid. And you put on a show every night at 7 o'clock.
Light show.
A light show. And it just runs dead center in the middle of the river between some of the Bonner Bridge and one of the other bridges. People would go, "Oh, why don't we stay an extra night and watch the show?"
Mm.
And it, once it's set up, it doesn't cost a lot to run.
Yeah.
And it's still...
Hong Kong's proved that.
Yes. So, you know, one of the things is the rituals of having regular shows of some form that get people to stay longer. When one of the tricks, I think in Melbourne, I can't remember which shopping center, it's got the big clock. And people hang around to see when the clock strikes the hour because it plays music, it does things. All these things get people to stay longer.
And you're right. Again, that's the second time you've taken me to Prague with the very famous clock in Prague, in the
people
city.
People hang around.
People wait there for hours to get up and have a look from upstairs.
And so, you know, this ability to create things that are happening that everybody can enjoy.
I also, you mentioned before, you know, buskers and music and art and light. I saw it all brought together quite recently down the cathedral just down the road, St. Stephen's, when the Queensland Symphony Orchestra, the cathedral is 150 years old this month, and there's a lot of celebrations. And one of those was the Queensland Symphony Orchestra with a couple of tenors and a couple of sopranos, two mass choirs, did Mozart's Mass down there. And my daughter bought me a ticket for my birthday. And I went down, I thought it'd be a lovely musical experience. I was interested to see what the shape of the building would do to the acoustics, but that's because of our background in construction, we think like that. But what hit me was the music was amazing. The travel of the sound with no amplification, whatever, was brilliant. But the light, what made the show, was just creating a different space with the light they used that fit the mood created by the music.
Yes.
And that's a real talent, and it just makes such a difference.
And do you know where that first started?
No.
Electric Kool-Aid acid tests in the 1960s, which is when in America when the LSD was legal, and they put on light shows and gave everyone Kool-Aid laced with LSD, and they got bands to play music.
Bring back the old days, I think.
But the point being, it's nothing new. I mean, churches have been doing it for yonks.
Yeah.
Stained glass windows.
Indeed, you're right.
And then they have the incense.
Yeah.
They have the ritual.
The smells and bells.
Yeah. And so there's nothing new. It's just interpreted in a different way.
Mm.
And whilst I'm joking about the electric Kool-Aid acid test, but the principles are still there. Anything that you do, if you can make it as immersive as possible, whether it is for something that is soulful, spiritual, self-reflective, through to something that's highly intense in your face. You've got to have all spectrums going when you're creating experiences, and they've got to. And for a city, you've got to have a variety. That's what makes a city walkable. It's the variety and diversification, celebrating every aspect of the city from First Nations through to where we are today, and acknowledging that we are a diverse city. I mean, the food here is amazing. Yeah, and there's a real fusion that could happen here. And I think one of the joys in the creative space is when you got two things that are quite different coming together and something quite special, magical happens.
There's a bit of that. We have the Greek festival and various other food festivals. But I think in all of these cases, we've got great examples of practically everything we've talked about. But your point is we need more of it and more frequently to be seen. Look, the time is beginning to run out. So I think we've done a great coverage of the principle of where neuroarchitecture came from and the principles from shopping center. I think you've extended that beautifully into the exterior and sort of things we could be doing to get people to linger while still giving the option to use the bridges and the pathways and the city experience transactionally if they choose to, but we're giving them something to choose between, you know, to get engaged with art or music or smells and sound.
Street theater, street art, sculptures. There's a lot of sculptures here that I love.
There are some nice ones.
The kangaroos.
They're cool.
For example.
In the dungaree shorts.
And what I call steampunk sculpture. There's a few of them around.
Yeah, I think we're seeing a lot of good things. We just need more of it.
Yeah.
So to summarize and bring it together, If you were to name a principle, two or three principles that define neuroarchitecture in a way that people can go away and say, well, neuroarchitecture exteriorly is all about these three things, all fewer or more if you think you need it, how would you describe it?
Well, that's a good question. I'm going to get shot down by someone on this.
Well, better you than me.
For me, it's engaging people. There's so much vanilla in life at the moment. There's so much white noise. And neuroarchitecture doesn't have to be in your face, but it's about creating an environment that supports our mental and physical well-being rather than hinders us. And the town planning laws and the compliance requirements do not encourage environments that support our mental and physical well-being.
So principle number one is that town planning needs to change. I guess the other one that you've talked about quite extensively is the maintaining that, you started with it and you've mentioned it several times, is maintaining that indoor-outdoor connection, get rid of the barriers so that people can experience the both simultaneously almost.
I think one of the joys of walking around any attractive city is that it's an experience that we all can have and it's free.
And if we were to draw one more so we give people a trio, am I right in coming back to your blanket of foliage over the city as far as possible? Are they the three key ones? Change the Town Planning Act.
So more indoor, outdoor, at ground level.
Indoor, outdoor, at ground level, and a canopy of foliage to be the best subtropical
city. But it grows down to the ground. It's all, you're immersed in it. If you were in a jungle, the foliage is right below you all the way up. And we shouldn't, as I said once, you should just have hairy buildings that are, the top floor's nice.
Yeah, where they've got the greenery to get the ESI points.
But have it at ground level. Have it the first 15 meters up. And so you're walking through foliage. You're not looking up at it. It's there, immersive. And if I was a visitor and I was told I was coming to the subtropical capital of Australia, a city in a jungle, I would expect to be completely immersed. Not tokenism. One of the worst things is tokenism.
Well, I think that's probably a good point to finish in avoiding tokenism. But I think you've given us a brilliant summary of the background to neuroarchitecture in your experience and your vision, I guess, to expand it into the broader environment and the indoor-outdoor, almost metaphorically moving out of the shopping centre into the savannah, as you said before, of Brisbane. And I think you've done that in a way that's aspirational for the city and something that I think this discussion, and particularly the comments you've made, we'll get a lot of people thinking and hopefully create and expand discussion. And for that, on behalf of the Committee for Brisbane, Michael, I thank you sincerely. Thank you very much for your time, your knowledge and your expertise.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.